Starting this month, gamblers in Pennsylvania are able to play blackjack, craps, and poker without crossing the state line. Casinos up and down the East Coast are adding table games. Industry experts say the growing competition is another bad break for Atlantic City, as Joel Rose reports.
For most of the 20th century, if you wanted to gamble in a casino, you had to go to Nevada. Then Atlantic City casinos opened in the 1970s. Now it seems like every state wants to get into the game, even Delaware.
Yeah, I played a lot of places all around the country, actually. Vegas, Atlantic City, St. Louis. But this works.
Vince Caesar is talking about the new poker room at Delaware Park in Wilmington. From the day it opened last month, it was packed. Players like Caesar and Joe Fallows, who no longer have to drive an hour or two to New Jersey to find a game.
Atlantic City's going to feel it. They're going to definitely feel it. There's so many regulars I see in here right now. And on a Friday and Saturday, they don't have enough tables.
Delaware Park hasn't been shy about luring players from neighboring states. In fact, it's been touting its new table games with a flurry of ads and billboards.
It's an extremely competitive marketplace right now. And everybody's got to get out there just to protect their own share.
Andrew Gentile is Delaware Park's general manager. He says while poker isn't as profitable as slots, he hopes table games will bring in new business.
Slot player is typically your female 45 and older. The poker player is predominantly male and a lot of retirees, but you're also seeing a lot of that younger generation that has kind of grown up in the last 10 years watching the World Series of Poker on ESPN.
But soon, those younger players will have even more choices. Casinos in Pennsylvania will start offering table games this month. Massachusetts is expected to legalize them, too. Creighton University economist Ernie Goss says the motivation for state governments is pretty obvious.
It's a way of getting tax revenues at a very fast clip. So there's a real, real incentive on the side of the state, on the side of the city to approve casinos.
But as states continue to legalize gambling, Goss says casinos find themselves fighting for a limited pool of customers.
To some degree, you're going to cannibalize casinos in other states. The industry is going to get much, much, much more competitive, particularly in the northeastern portion of the U.S.
For New Jersey, the timing couldn't be worse. The recession, coupled with increased slots competition from Pennsylvania, has already pushed revenues at all Atlantic City casinos down for 2 years in a row. Linda Cassakert heads the New Jersey Casino Control Commission.
People are spending less. So while they may be coming to Atlantic City, and we know that they are coming because our room nights are up, they're being more careful about how they spend their money.
Pretty much the lone bright spot for Atlantic City has been the Borgata. In a town with a bit of a reputation for seediness, the Borgata offers high-end shopping and restaurants. That's why Senior VP Joe Lupo says he's not so worried about new competition from other states.
It's the fine dining that we have here at Borgata. It's the entertainment program, the spa. It's those other amenities that I think is what turned Las Vegas into the gambling mecca. And I think you're seeing non-gaming revenue slowly increase here in Atlantic City.
For Atlantic City to compete with more convenient options, other casinos in town will likely have to follow the upscale Las Vegas model. But the recession has made that tougher, too. A few years ago, investors were ready to bet $10 billion on casino projects. Now, those construction cranes stand idle while Atlantic City waits for its luck to turn. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
This is NPR. Concern that the U.S. economic recovery is faltering has ignited a furious political debate over how the government should respond. Democrats want more stimulus, while Republicans want to reduce the federal deficit. Both argue that the other's remedy could send the country back into recession or depression. As NPR's John Itzde reports, a couple of prominent economists from each side are now calling for a more nuanced approach.
There's little middle ground in the political argument over whether the economy needs more stimulus or fiscal discipline. Here's Democratic Majority Whip Dick Durbin on the Senate floor.
The Republicans come to us now and say, we've got to stop putting money back into the economy. It creates a deficit. Yes, it does. But if you don't get the 14 million unemployed Americans back to work, the deficit will get worse.
Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell had this response.
What we're not willing to do is to use worthwhile programs as an excuse to burden our children and our grandchildren with an even bigger national debt than we've already got.
This is one of those sad cases where subtlety is needed and subtlety doesn't come through in political debates.
That's Alan Blinder, once an economic advisor to President Clinton and a former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve. He says the truth is the country needs both more stimulus and deficit reduction, but in different time frames. And Blinder has some notable company from the other side.
My view is we should do both.
Alan Meltzer advised conservative icon Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s. He's now a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. First, says Meltzer, the government must address the deficit by answering this question.
How are we going to handle a deficit and debt that everyone recognizes, including the administration, is unsustainable? Well, let's announce a policy and say, not that we're going to make draconian cuts in expenditures starting tomorrow, but that we have a plan for bringing this down.
And there also needs to be stimulus, says Meltzer, but not from spending.
Cancel the rest of the current stimulus program and replace it by a program that will work. And that's a program which cuts corporate taxes.
Alan Blinder, now a professor at Princeton, agrees with Meltzer that President Obama needs to outline a more detailed plan to begin bringing down the deficit, starting at some date in the future, probably 2012. He does warn that starting serious deficit reduction immediately could send the economy spiraling. But Blinder disagrees with Meltzer that corporate tax cuts would be a good form of stimulus.
The evidence on business tax cuts is extremely mixed. So I wouldn't put much store in business tax cuts. A permanent cut in income taxes, if we could afford it, would stimulate the economy. But we cannot afford it. Whatever we do has to be temporary.
Blinder also warns a repeat of President Obama's $787 billion hodgepodge stimulus bill is not what's needed. What is needed, he argues, is a huge program of tax credits for businesses that create jobs.
And or an overt jobs creation program analogous to the WPA during the Depression. What unites those two ideas is that they're very efficient at creating jobs per dollar of deficit.
Blinder also supports the effort to extend expiring unemployment benefits, which has stalled in the Congress.
Extending unemployment benefits is one of the best forms of stimulus we know.
Republicans have blocked the benefit extension, arguing it will increase the deficit. John Idsty, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. The bad news is that the nation's labor market is limping. The good news, at least according to President Obama, is that it's still moving in the right direction.
We're not headed there fast enough for a lot of Americans. We're not headed there fast enough for me either. The recession dug us a hole of about 8 million jobs deep.
And months like June aren't going to get the country out of that hole anytime soon. The government's monthly jobs report released this morning found layoffs of temporary census workers more than offset private sector job growth. Overall, the economy shed 125,000 jobs last month. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
Here's how you get to that number. The private sector created 83,000 jobs, but the public sector, government, was in serious negative territory. The census cut its payroll by 225,000 in June. Kathy Lee was among those cut. She started in April as an enumerator, counting San Diego residents who hadn't sent back their census forms.
And we went, knocked on their doors, and tried to fill out the survey with them.
Lee says she knew the job was temporary, but she hoped it would last until she found a full-time permanent job. Then one day in early June, her census gig ended abruptly.
And it was like, oh, no, I think we're pretty much done. This will be your last day. Like, literally, that's what happened.
But temporary census workers weren't the only government employees who got layoff notices in June. Kenny Druce was a patrolman in the Franklin Township Police Department in New Jersey.
Oh, I loved it. I wanted to be a cop since I was a kid.
Now he's applying for unemployment, and so is his wife, a kindergarten teacher. He says they both lost their jobs because of tight local budgets.
It's not so much the money that's the hard part, but we both loved what we did. I was just interested in it, and I wanted to do it. And my wife loved kids, and she wanted to be a teacher.
So far this year, state and local governments have cut 50,000 jobs, and many economists expect it to get worse, which puts that much more pressure on the private sector to lead the way out of this jobless recovery, says Philip Jefferson. He's a professor of economics at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania.
It's not until we see robust job growth in the private sector that Americans are going to start to feel better and feel as though we're really turning the corner.
So what is robust? It would be a lot more than the 83,000 private sector jobs added in June.
The direction is right, but there's definitely room for improvement.
Lisa Lynch is dean of the Public Policy School at Brandeis University and a former chief economist at the Labor Department. The private sector has created jobs for 6 months straight, but not enough, she says.
Really what you want to see is month after month of 200,000 or more jobs added to the economy, the majority of those coming out of the private sector.
And we aren't even close to that.
No, 83,000 is a long way from 200,000.
One bright spot in the report comes with such a massive caveat that no one is celebrating. The unemployment rate dropped to 9.5%. Peter Morisi is an economist at the University of Maryland.
The unemployment rate fell simply because 650,000 adults quit the labor force. They stopped looking for work. They gave up frustrated, so they don't count.
Morisi says if you count all the people who are discouraged and those who would like to work full-time but only have part-time jobs, the unemployment rate would be more like 16%. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
Elected officials in California blew the deadline this week to pass a new state budget. That's a familiar failure in that state. Yesterday, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger invoked what he says is state law, that until a budget is in place, employees of the state can only receive minimum wage. And today, an appellate court agreed with him. But the man who actually writes the state's paychecks, California State Comptroller John Chong, says that's a mistake.
We ought to keep it a political dispute among the governor and legislature and leave the good people of California out of their political battle.
John Myers covers California State House for member station KQED, and he joins us now. And John, given the controller's misgivings about this, can he tell Governor Schwarzenegger, sorry, no dice?
Well, you know, Melissa, the appeals court decision earlier today says no, he can't. But the state controller has decided to appeal this fight. He said he'll appeal it probably to the Supreme Court. That was expected. You know, part of what's happening here is that the California state controller is independently elected by the voters. So in effect here in California, you've got the chief financial officer who thinks he doesn't answer to the chief executive officer, the governor. The state controller, John Chung, who you heard from is a Democrat. And of course, as we know, Arnold Schwarzenegger is a Republican. So there's probably some politics in all of it. But I think at the end of the day, we're really talking about what the state can and cannot pay when there's no budget in place. And, you know, none of this would be happening if the governor and the state legislature had come to an agreement on a new budget for California by the beginning of the fiscal year, which was Thursday. They did not. And so now you got an awful lot of employees of the state wondering about that paycheck come August.
Yeah. How many workers would this affect?
Well, we're talking about 200,000 state workers would have their pay dramatically cut. And, you know, the average state worker in California earns about $65,000 a year. So we're talking about federal minimum wage, which is $7.25 an hour, obviously a dramatic lowering of those paychecks and could have a ripple effect in communities all across the state.
Yeah, what are you hearing about that? How much of a ripple effect would that be?
Well, you know, these are rank and file. They work at every state agency. I mean, you know, whether it's a DMV, you know, Division of Motor Vehicles, whether it's other agencies around the state. And, of course, you know, in communities like here in the state capital in Sacramento that has a real cluster of the state workforce, I think there are a lot of community officials who would be really worried about the economic impacts. And don't forget, California has been hit harder by this global recession than a lot of places. So this could have serious impact if, in fact, it happens.
Yeah. And, John, does this light a fire under folks saying, look, we better figure out a way to pass this budget?
I think it might have to, because, I mean, you know, the real question here is what can the state pay in the absence of a budget? And one of the reasons that we're getting to this whole problem is that, frankly, the state computer system that actually issues these paychecks is so antiquated. It's from the 1970s. That's why the controller says he can't make it work that fast to change all of this. But, you know, the courts are telling him he might have to. So it'll be interesting to see what politicians, the governor and the legislature, do as a result.
Okay, John, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
John Myers covers California's State House for member station KQED.